This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Sudanese people could not be more unified and clear. They want an end to this war now. They want full humanitarian access, and they want their future back.
That's Tom Perriello, the U.S. Department of State's special envoy for Sudan. Details coming up. Also, a new report says famine is imminent in northern Gaza. And clashes between two communities kills 42 in Chad. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. A senior U.S. official has warned the efforts to end Sudan's conflict have reached a time of incredible urgency and urged the international community to meet the immediate humanitarian needs of the Sudanese people. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Tom Perriello, the U.S. Department of State Special Envoy for Sudan and the Middle East, to demonstrate the priority U.S. ending the conflict in Sudan.
At a time of incredible urgency, on this trip, we have been visiting with Sudanese across Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya, Djibouti, and Egypt, as well as meeting with our African counterparts, and now visiting with our counterparts in Saudi Arabia, and finally the United Arab Emirates.
There are growing fears that the Sudan conflict could lead to new crises in a region battered by conflict and drought. Speaking during an online news briefing on Thursday, the U.S. diplomat said he met with a range of Sudanese civilians, including civil society, women and youth, to hear their perspectives on how to bolster efforts to respond to urgent needs and end the conflict.
The Sudanese people could not be more unified and clear. They want an end to this war now. They want full humanitarian access, and they want their future back. And it is our job, all of us who care about the people of Sudan, around the world, around this neighborhood and beyond, to be urgently seized with the project of ending this war, preventing the worst of this famine, and giving the Sudanese people a chance to determine their own future.
On Wednesday, the United Nations warned that the brutal fighting in Sudan is driving a hunger crisis, with some areas likely to experience catastrophic levels of food insecurity in the coming months. Perriello gave more details.
This is an urgent situation where we are seeing signs of famine already across the country of Sudan. We have known about horrific atrocities, particularly against women and children, forced recruitment, even slavery in this conflict that must end.
The conflict between the Sudanese army and the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces has left 18 million people, more than a third of the population, facing acute food insecurity. The UN says up to 15,000 people have been killed since the fighting broke out in mid-April last year. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where 70% of people are experiencing catastrophic hunger, according to a report released this week by the International Community's Authority on Hunger Severity. The report warns any escalation of the war could push half of Gaza's population to the brink of starvation. Israel is facing increasing pressure to streamline the entry of aid into the Gaza Strip and open more land crossings. Aid groups complain deliveries by air and sea by the U.S. and other nations are inefficient and are coming too late. Bob Kitchen, Vice President for Emergencies at the International Rescue Committee, IRC, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the humanitarian suffering in Gaza could all be avoided if Israel would allow emergency supplies to get through at the border.
The data coming out from the UN is that more than half of the people in northern Gaza are already likely in the conditions that are used with the F word, famine. The two of the three criteria are probably met already. And that proportion decreases slightly as you go into the middle of the strip, and then declines again as you get to the southern half, where there's greatest access. And that's the key here, is humanitarian access, being able to deliver aid to the people who need it most urgently, where it is comparatively, it is not easy, but it is comparatively easy now to do that in Rafah, and then it becomes incrementally more difficult as you move further north.
Now, we've heard from a couple of U.S. congressmen that recently visited Rafah, right there along the border and where the trucks are being held up, and other people that are in that area, that there are just piles of trucks being held up. Is it possible, from what you have been told and what you can see there, that there can be more ease of and more flexibility in the way that this is being conducted over the border, so that more humanitarian aid can get into Gaza if Israel would allow it?
100%. I think we need to be clear here that normally when we see catastrophic food security, when we have seen twice in the last 12 years, previously famine, it is a combination of climate change, so underlying fragility that's driven by the change the climate has made to people's ability to farm and to harvest, and always compounded by conflict, where access to markets, the delivery of aid, has compromised people's ability to survive. That is not the case in Gaza. There is no climate change dynamic. This is purely man-made. It is purely as a result of violence and intentional bureaucracy that is stopping the delivery of humanitarian aid. That is, if you've ever needed an example of life-saving, this is it, here and now, where there are millions of people on the brink of starvation because we can't get aid in. We can't get it in because of the constraints on those trucks lining up that have to be checked. Things are being pulled out, trucks are being returned. And then once we're in, because of the bombing, because of the checkpoints, because of the violence, we can't take the trucks further north into Gaza.
Is it that critical now, where you're saying starvation? Are people, children especially, are they dying from starvation?
We're on the brink of that. That's what the declaration of famine means, that the mortality rates, excess mortality rates, have risen to a degree where people are now dying because of hunger. Now, people rarely die because of hunger. It is complications that come associated with extreme hunger. It's when a human body is that hungry, it starts to close down. And then it's very exposed to waterborne diseases and other contagious diseases that, sadly, are also drastically on the rise in Gaza, because there's not enough water, there's not enough power, there's not enough fuel to power the desalination plants, so people have free access to clean water, which they did before the conflict. Again, man-made disaster. And because of the violence, the concentration of population from across the strip into the southern part, into Rafah, has led to massive overcrowding. So we have thousands of people trying to share individual toilets. So they're overflowing. People don't wait to use the toilets. They go elsewhere. And that turbocharges the risk to life through cholera or just diarrhea. People die because of dehydration.
That's Bob Kitchen, Vice President for Emergencies at the IRC, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from New York. The Israeli officials, including Foreign Minister Israel Katz and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have said Israel is working to get more aid into Gaza and have blamed Hamas for disrupting or stealing aid. They also have said that Israel must search all cargo into the enclave for weapons and other material that the Hamas militants can use in the fight against Israeli forces. The Hamas organization, which governs Gaza, began the war in October with an attack on communities in Israel that left about 1,200 people dead. Hamas also kidnapped about 250 people, many of whom remain hostages in Gaza. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry estimates nearly 32,000 people in the territory have died in the war, most of them civilians. The war in Gaza has become a major issue in the U.S. presidential campaign. Over the weekend, President Joe Biden embraced the general tenor, if not all the specifics, of a speech last week by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish leader in the U.S., called for new elections in Israel, saying Prime Minister Netanyahu has lost his way in overseeing the war. Netanyahu responded by saying Schumer's call for a snap election was totally inappropriate. On the Republican side, former President Donald Trump said Jews who support Democrats hate Israel and their religion. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Schumer's third in line to the presidency. He's the fourth highest official in the United States officially. Getting up in front of the U.S. Senate and giving an official 40-minute speech. Now, he told the New York Times that he almost called for Netanyahu to resign immediately and change his mind and called for new elections, which shows how angry he was. And here he gives an official speech on the Senate floor and says there are four obstacles to peace in Israel and Palestine. Hamas, the most right-wing government in history, Fatah, and Netanyahu. That's just unprecedented. I think Netanyahu is the only one named by name other than the right-wing leaders Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. And frankly, if Schumer was going to be honest, he could have added the U.S. to the list of obstacles to peace, because it's been the U.S. that hasn't been allowing, you know, ceasefire resolutions to pass at the United Nations and has been sort of blocking others from trying to bring the war to the end. And I didn't agree with every word that Schumer said, but it was hugely significant, and it can be seen potentially as a turning point in this war. I don't think we're there yet. Others think we may be. In terms of the inappropriateness, Netanyahu himself directly undermined U.S. politics in 2014 in the example just gave. He often tries to put his finger on the scale in U.S. politics, not only in the presidential race, but in the Senate, House, and local races. As many of the listeners will know, the Jewish lobby in the United States is the most powerful one, along with the pro-firearms lobby. And AIPAC is the largest organization that, which spends hundreds of millions of dollars in every election cycle. Arab voters and Muslim voters who are voting uncommitted in the primaries, but privately saying they could never, ever, ever vote for Biden because of the genocide in Gaza, are almost lost in many respects to Biden's attempt to ruin the White House. And now young progressives are splitting from it too, including young Jewish people. But I think Biden and Schumer are now aiming less at Arab and Muslim voters who have almost given up on them in certain swing states and are trying to win over larger numbers of Jewish and centrist voters who may be able to be won back with a policy that's pro-peace and pro-2 states.
But as Gaza war became an election issue, what's your response to Trump's statement depicting American Jews who would vote Democratic as enemies of Israel and enemies of their own faith?
Well, the response was correct from Schumer and the U.S. administration and most American Jews that are in leadership positions that this is anti-Semitism. The sort of dual loyalty thing we used to have in the United States, you know, you couldn't be a president and be Catholic because you must be loyal to Ireland or the Pope or something. And there's a bigoted anti-Semitic problem there when you say you're not Jewish if you don't support Netanyahu and you don't support the war. But I think that argument is sort of sophisticated. I think a lot of Americans don't quite capture how supporting Israel is anti-Semitism, which is why Trump is dumbing down the argument and trying to make it, you know, just a loyalty test, which is what autocratic and fascistic leaders like Trump always try to reduce politics to, you know, your team, my team. And if you're not on my team, you're betraying your team, you're betraying your country, you're betraying your faith, you're a disgrace. You know, that's the way they talk. I think Schumer's impassioned response, you know, will be lost on a lot of Americans. And I think what needs to happen here is Biden has to get up and make the case for peace, make the case for the two-state solution, make the case that bringing this war to an end, stopping the famine, getting the hostages, changing the leadership in both Israel and Palestine and making that part of a larger normalization with the Arab and Muslim world, if the Palestinians get a viable state, which is the Saudi position, then that's the only way to go. That's the pro-Israel position. I think if they sort of fall in the trap of anti-Semitic or not anti-Semitic, the trap that Trump's trying to lay for them, they may not win that argument. They'll have to shoot higher and shoot wider and make the case for peace, make the case for protecting civilians, make the case for ending the war as being in the best interests of the United States and of Israel.
That was William Lawrence, a professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Clashes between two communities have killed at least 42 people in Chad, in a region often hit by disputes between groups over land. The French news agency AFP reports that a public security ministry has not said who was involved in the fighting, but says 175 people were arrested. The Cameroon government has threatened to arrest opposition parties for seeking to create coalitions and alliances for a transitional government to oust 90-year-old President Paul Biya, who has been in power for more than four decades. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji last week ordered an end to activities of the Political Alliance for Change and the Alliance for Political Transition in Cameroon. Nji said only legally recognized political parties have the right to exercise political activities in Cameroon, and leaders and civilians who join the two illegal alliances would be arrested. Cameroon opposition and civil society groups say the recent ban on activities of the two alliances is another indication that Cameroon disrespects democracy and fundamental rights to freedoms. Roger Justin Noah is a spokesperson of the opposition Cameroon Renaissance Movement. The CRM is led by Maurice Kamto, who claims he have won the October 2018 presidential election and that President Paul Biya stole his victory.
Il s'agit d'un mouvement de partis politiques qui soutiennent la candidature de Maurice Kamto.
Noah says Cameroon's opposition will not be intimidated by Cameroon government officials and supporters of President Biya. He says the Cameroon government has become nervous about the growing popularity opposition leader Maurice Kamto has after more than 30 civil society and opposition groups joined the political alliance with change that Kamto leads. Noah said the alliance is encouraging Cameroonians who are unhappy with Biya's more than four decades rule to register to vote in the 2025 presidential polls and report any incidents of fraud or irregularities. Opposition parties say the Cameroon government is exhibiting bad faith by banning opposition coalitions but allowing other parties to gather support for Biya's ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement. René Emmanuel Sadi is Cameroon's communication minister and government spokesperson. He says there is no reason for some opposition parties to create alliances for a political transition in Cameroon when state institutions are fully functioning and Biya is indisputably exercising his functions. Sadi, who spoke in an interview broadcast by Cameroon State Radio CRTV this week and the international media organ RFI several times within the past 7 days, said the political opposition and civil society are exerting pressure on Biya to declare if he will be a candidate in 2025.
Le président de la République s'est prononcé publiquement et ceci à plusieurs reprises.
He says President Biya has on several occasions said that it will be in 2025, shortly before his current mandate ends, that Cameroonians and the international community will be informed of his plans to leave power or not. Sadi says the decision on if Biya will run will be made between the Cameroonian leader and supporters of his ruling CPDM party. Sadi said Cameroon is a democratic country and only the Cameroonian people will decide who their leader will be. The government also threatened to arrest members of the alliances who the government says visited jailed rebel leaders to negotiate an end to a separatist crisis that has killed over 6,000 people in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. The separatists say they want to create an independent English-speaking state out of the domineering French-speaking majority Cameroon. Cameroon's opposition accuses the Biya government of using excessive military force instead of negotiations and dialogue to solve what the opposition says is a political crisis in English-speaking regions. Biya is Africa's second longest-serving leader. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
According to a paper written for the Royal United Services Institute, Russia has sought to increase its influence across Africa. With the death of Wagner leader Evgeny Prigozhin, President Vladimir Putin has utilized the private mercenary group for regime survival packages. VOA's Anthony Labruto spoke to Oleksandr Danilyuk, the paper's author and former head of the Ukrainian National Security and Defense Council, to find out more about the packages and how they are seeking to undermine democracies across the continent.
Yeah, it's a good point. So, and actually, we have to say that despite Russia is so good in offering that so-called regime survival package to that local authoritarian, Russia is not loyal to its clients. And in this regard, what's going on in Sudan right now, it's an example as well, for sure, you know. And also it's very typical Russian, you know, approach for the colonialism, because first step is to establish contacts with some local leaders, and after that to find some other guys, you know, in that country who would be more keen, you know, to cooperate on Russian terms, right? So this is actually the way of how Russia literally reduces significantly even autonomy and sovereignty of that not very democratic regimes. So it's not just against people of that country, but pretty often against, you know, that authoritarian leader.
Is the whole purpose of them, I guess, with the regime survival package just to destabilize, or is it, you know, more of an appeasement, I guess, to a dictator? Or is it simply just to counter, you know, a democratic regime coming up, or a pro-Western regime?
Well, it's just like so all of that is a different problem in different parts of the political spectrum. I mean that it's not just some rebels or armed or things like extremists of different, or actually freedom fighters. It's also a serious economic problems, you know, it's some potential conflicts with neighbors, and the regime survival package, it's like all of the necessary tools, you know, combined in one kit. And that's why what we as Wagner, it's usually just a group of mercenaries responsible for providing some military services. But in fact, Russia provides much more than that. It's
Oleksandr Danilyuk, former head of the Ukrainian National Security, speaking with VOA's Anthony Labruto. Kenyan doctors have stopped providing emergency services at public hospitals as they escalate a national strike that entered its second week. The Associated Press report that thousands of doctors have stayed away from hospitals since last Thursday over what they say is poor pay and bad working conditions. The Kenyan Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentist Union Secretary General said today that doctors had stopped providing bare minimum services because the government had shown no effort to resolve the dispute. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.